Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. Today is episode 24 of our podcast for September 21st, 2011. I'm Ben.
And I'm Kai.
We have been talking quite a bit about Appalachia, so we're planning on just touching that for a moment. We're not going to take a whole podcast again and talk about Appalachia, but we want to bring that into the realm of anarchical communities, living without a state, and the peace and freedom that comes with it, and where that exists and has existed all around the world in different times and different cultures, and the Appalachia as an example of that. But before we get into that, we did miss a week, and so we thought we'd kind of give you an update on why and how that took place and so forth. The Bad Quaker website is owned by my wife Cindy, and she's our admin, and then Kai and I do these podcasts, and then we also do articles, plus we put stolen articles up occasionally. That's always fun. So Cindy's mother fell very ill, and we had to drop everything and drive cross country to be with her and make sure that she got the kind of care that she needed. And that took about a week. And although they do have internet access in that part of the world, we didn't have any, other than the MP3 player, microphone, and so forth that we took with us so that I could do interviews once we got there. We didn't really have a way to maintain the website and access it and everything in a secure manner, so we had to pretty much abandon Bad Quaker for a week. Kai was still here in Ohio and holding down the fort and everything with her at her household, and trying to keep all of our animals and everything alive over here at the Bad Quaker
Animal Rescue Foundation.
Yeah.
The home for abandoned animals.
Yeah. But that was too much of a burden for her to do all those things and maintain her job at the Renaissance Festival. And
by the way, if you're in the southwestern Ohio region and you're not doing anything for the next couple weekends, come out to the Ohio Renaissance Festival and buy things. Spend lots and lots and lots of money.
And that endorsement is not a paid-for endorsement. It's just that Renaissance festivals are fun. Especially if you go there and you spend money.
But not on the beer or the food, because that just goes to the Renaissance festival. Spend it at the booths, because that goes to us Rennies.
Anyway, so we skipped a podcast last week, and we skipped any articles. But we did yesterday. That was Tuesday the 20th. If you haven't heard it yet, you should download the interview that I did with Alan while we were there in Missouri. Alan's got quite a story to tell, and we only had an hour, so we could only just really touch on it. But I think you'll find what we covered fascinating in that interview. I was going to pick on... I can't let it pass. I was going to pick... Coming back on the road, I'm flipping around through the radio trying to find something to keep us entertained and awake as we're driving across the vast expanse of corn and soybean fields that we refer to as...
Your tax money at work.
Yeah, subsidized. Anyway, the comedian Haywood Banks has a song that he was inspired to write as he drove towards Indianapolis. And I'm going to butcher it horribly, but Haywood Banks' song goes something like, corn, 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 soybeans, corn, 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 on the way to Indianapolis, or something to that effect. Anyway, Haywood Banks is hilarious. And that's pretty much life as you're driving down the highway going across southern Illinois and across Indiana. It's just... miles and miles and miles of subsidized corn and soybean fields.
Subsidized, fascist, genetically modified corn.
Yeah, destroying the corn market for the rest of the world that could be growing corn and making a living off of it. And here we use tax dollars to subsidize farmers to grow it in mass in
so
ways.
So that there's cheap corn syrup available to inject in all your food. Including in places like meat.
French fries. Meat. Sure. You ever wonder why those fast food restaurant foods taste different than what when you fry up hamburgers and cook some French fries at home? You know?
Corn syrup.
Yay. And then they lie to you on the commercial. They say, oh, but high fructose corn syrup, your body doesn't know the difference between... Yes, it does. Fructose and sucrose are two different chemicals. It's not the same thing.
And they're broken down in two different organs of the body.
Yeah, this is not even what... We're not going to talk about this. But we could!
I'm looking at you, Monsanto.
Oh, anyway...
Or should I say the new head of the FDA? Mm. Hi. That's not fascism.
Crony capitalism. It's not at all crony capitalism when you hire the Monsanto employees into the White House. Okay, that wasn't the topic, but you want to hit Appalachia?
Speaking of crony capitalism.
Oh my. Okay, so what we wanted to touch on Appalachia was simply that Appalachia was, prior to the establishment of the U.S. government, after the War of Independence, the Constitution became ratified, Appalachia had already existed for over 100 years as a unique, separate, non-state culture.
Mm-hmm. At least 100 years.
At least 100 years prior to the ratification of the Constitution. Once the Constitution was ratified and the state became a real entity in among the 13 states, states being two different words, but like deer and deer.
Big state and little state.
Yeah. When the state became an entity with the ratification of the Constitution, it immediately started seeking ways to attack, engulf, and devour the free Appalachian people.
No.
One of the first things the state did was to use the whiskey tax, the unconstitutional whiskey tax, only a couple of years after the Constitution was ratified. Our first president, George Washington, George the First, illegally, against the Constitution, got the whiskey tax passed. I have an article on this.
Then we could get back to the Constitution.
Yeah. Then used the whiskey tax to essentially attack the Appalachians.
Which was also fascism.
Yes, exactly.
Because
he was the major whiskey producer at the time.
Funny that.
So the whiskey tax benefited George Washington probably more than it did the government itself. But anyway, where were we? So the state, the constitutional government of the United States, the state, began attacking Appalachia within the first couple years of its existence and never let up.
Mm-hmm.
All the way up into the 1800s when the state demanded that counties be established throughout Appalachia for the purpose of controlling and taxation, when they started sending the...
The census takers recording
and dividing the people.
How many of their slaves they had. Because mm-hmm. you can't own something if you can't count it.
And when slaves, you're talking not about the Appalachians owning slaves, which they didn't. You're talking about the Appalachians being the slaves of the state.
Yes.
The state needs to count its slaves. That's been the case through every manifestation of the state. One of the first things they like to do is have a census and start counting what they own and what the possessions of their slaves are.
In fact, we should probably just not call it a census. We should just call it inventory.
Inventory, yeah. When the Normans came into England and they began bringing the census with them, the people of England referred to it as the Doomsday Book,
mm-hmm.
because that's what it was. It was the end of time for them. It was the end of life. It was the end of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get counted and once you become inventoried, you're part of the inventory of the state, and you're officially owned by the state. And that's the ancient English knew that. They understood that. When the Normans started counting them, it was because the Normans felt that they owned them.
Yep.
And that's what the census is. And the Appalachian people understood that when they... There's always been this animosity between Appalachians and the census takers. And a lot of times, even the Appalachians don't understand where it comes from. They just know that they have it. Mm-hmm. And that's where it comes from. It comes from that deep understanding that to count you means you are the property of someone else.
Yep. And you know, the Social Security numbers are the same way. You know, you're being assigned an inventory number.
Yeah, and try to work without one.
Yeah.
You know, try to function in society without a Social Security number.
Yep.
So Appalachia began being attacked as soon as the state was formalized with the ratification of the Constitution. But the big onslaught into Appalachia didn't take place until the big, the corporation-backed coal companies, the coal corporations began moving into Appalachia. Let me back up a little bit.
Well, because I wanted to touch on the fact that there's a lot of mythology involved in the coal corporations. People have this tendency to go, oh, they're evil, and the government came in and they saved the people from these evil corporations. But in truth, in actuality, the corporations were there strictly because they got specific government regulations that allowed them to exist and did not allow...
All right. Okay, we had a break there in the recording. We had to interrupt our podcast with some free market agorism entirely outside of the processes of the state that took place. And I guess we'll just leave it at that. So, and you can look that up if you're not sure what that means. It's agorism. Agorism. It is the concept of doing business in a free society and not supporting the state with your activities, not supporting the state-supported corporations and their whole system of aggression and taxation and so forth. So anyway, what we were talking about was the invasion of Appalachia by the corporations, and Kai was talking about how the corporations... are the evil, it's portrayed to us. This is a regular lie that we're given to by the state. The corporation invades a sector of a community or a sector of the market, and then there's an outcry, and then the state rushes in and is the hero for getting control of the evil corporations, when in actuality the state created the evil corporation. The state created the opportunity for the corporation to invade, and then the state never took the corporation away. All it did was put some fluffy regulations around the corporation so that the corporation funnels more money back to the state.
And meanwhile, keeps small business that would compete with the corporations completely out of business.
Yes.
Because they can't compete with the regulations.
So now, how are you applying that to Appalachia? With the coal.
Well, in the beginning, mm-hmm. In Appalachia, there were independent people
mm-hmm.
who would go into the hills
mm-hmm.
and they would get coal
right.
and they would get pig iron mm-hmm. and they would get these commodities
mm-hmm.
And then they would take them into town and they would sell them or trade them or what have you.
Let me interrupt real quick. Scattered all over Appalachia, there are still some of these old furnaces left. But scattered around Appalachia, there were large stone-quarried furnaces that were handmade. And the Appalachian people would hand-dig using things like ox carts and hand shovels and picks and so forth. They would hand-dig iron ore and coal out of the mountains. This is mostly surface excavation, but there was some actual mining that took place as well. And they would extract this, bring it to these furnaces, load it with a shot of coal and a shot of iron ore, and then produce pig iron. And they would then fill their carts with pig iron and coal and then carry it into the cities outside of Appalachia. That's what you're referring to.
Which is a shockingly environmentally friendly process.
Yes, it was.
Because, again, it's all surface stuff. You know, they're not digging these deep wells where miners are going in and mines collapsing, and it's not this horrible, dangerous thing. It's relatively safe, painless, relatively environmentally friendly.
Yeah, and they're not removing whole tops of hills and doing this, whole tops of mountains. And the other thing, when they would set up these furnaces and smelt a load of iron ore, what a lot of people don't realize is if you have a short stack on a fire, a smelter like that with a short stack, then it produces some smoke, although the hotter you get that fire, the less smoke there is. But whatever residues come from this fire, they only go up as high as is needed for a draft for that furnace, and then they fall right back down in that area.
Right.
So if pollution takes place, it takes place on the land of the guy who owns the furnace.
Right.
Now, if you take the same substances, these same things, coal and the iron ore and the different things, and you take them into the big factories and the corporations where they have their huge iron ore or iron mills, and you smelt it there with their really tall stacks, then what happens is the same quantity of pollutants are produced by the same pound for pound of coal.
And they all go into the air.
And they go way up into the atmosphere, because these tall stacks carry it up through the draft process. They carry it up real high up into the air, and then it floats out into the atmosphere for miles and miles and miles, and some of it gets caught up higher up into the atmosphere and literally doesn't come down.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have the pollutant problems that we have with big factories. Pound for pound, having a smelting furnace on your property where it only pollutes your property and you can deal with the pollutant right there locally is much more environmentally friendly than having a massive corporation with these stacks that shoot way up into the air and the pollution goes all off to where it pollutes people who have nothing to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what corporations end up doing as opposed to these private little smelting operations. Now, I just interrupted your whole flow there, but I wanted to throw that out, that type of production is much more environmentally friendly.
And the reason that the stacks are high in big factories is specifically because of regulations from the government.
Yeah. Because polluters in the early 1800s, you're really taking me off in a different direction. In the early 1800s in England, if you had a smokestack for your factory, and the smokestack was high enough that the debris floated off onto someone else's property, you were liable for the damage that your smokestack caused to someone else's property. So, for instance, the classic example is a woman puts out her laundry out on the line to dry, and a factory a half mile away, the soot from their factory gets her laundry dirty. She sues. And that company then has to pay her damages for the pollution that fell on her property.
Right.
So when this shift took place in England, favoring corporations over individuals and favoring corporations over private companies, they changed the law so that all the factory had to do was put a tall enough stack out so that you couldn't tell where it came from.
Right.
Now, the pollution's still polluting the woman's laundry on her line. It's just that you can't prove where it came from.
Right.
So this preference that when the government shifted and went from protecting individuals to protecting corporations, when that shift took place, it was specifically because the state interfered with the normal function of the market and took the side of the corporations over the individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's take that back to Appalachia.
Almost lost where I was.
So the state used its own aggressions to allow corporations to come into Appalachia, and then you were going from there. And the myth that the state is going to save the people from the evil corporations.
Right. And you know, this is a myth that we see time and time again. There's this myth of, you know, the monopoly busters or the trust busters or all of these things, but it's a lie.
Mm-hmm.
Because the state doesn't take away monopolies. The state creates monopolies.
Right.
And it may and create a panoply. It may create two or three favored corporations.
Right.
But it destroys individual business.
Right.
So you have the situation where corporations were given specific tax breaks, specific incentives, specific, you know, all of these things. And you know, oh, it's to promote jobs and to promote, you know, all of this. And so these mining corporations went into Appalachia and... Of course, they did what any corporation does, which is horribly exploit their employees, terribly damage the environment,
right,
and do it all while using funds stolen from the people.
Right, from taxpayers.
Through government subsidies.
Exactly. And in Appalachia, when the moment came when the people of Appalachia began to understand how they were being exploited by these corporations... Their natural response was to fight back against it, and unfortunately, the method provided to them by the state was the unions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is going to be confusing for some union supporters when you hear this. You're going to think that I'm nuts, or that I'm some kind of anti-union person, or that I'm, you know, but the fact is, unions are hand-in-hand the best friends of the corporations.
They really are.
They're not the friends of the workers. They work with the corporations to tie the hands of the workers into contracts that the workers, individual workers, have no say-so about.
And this is clearly shown in Appalachia, because pre-union, there was a system in place where you were not tied to a contract saying you have to work this time, you have to work this time.
Yeah.
You worked when you wanted to work.
Yeah.
You worked when there was work.
Right.
You know, you showed up, let's say on a Tuesday, you showed up and you said, is there work? And if there's work, you work. And if there's not work, you go home and you farm.
And if the coal company wanted you to work a 14-hour day and you didn't want to, you just went home.
Yeah.
That was the end of it. And if they didn't want to employ you under those circumstances, then that's fine. And if you didn't want to be employed under those circumstances, then that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But once the unions came in, presenting salvation to the workers through things like the 8-hour day and the 5-day work week and things like this, you're locked into it.
Mm-hmm.
And now all of a sudden, if you know, 3 or 4 people out of a crew of 500 don't want to work those hours, too bad.
Yeah.
Work it. Or don't work at all.
Yeah.
Because this is how everybody is doing it. It becomes a standardization. It's socialism. Unions, in that sense, are the true level of socialism brought into capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Which, what do we call that?
That's fascism.
Exactly.
And you know, it's not an issue of, oh, they're exploiting these people by making them work 14-hour work days. Nobody's making you do that. You know, pre-union, no one was making you do that.
At least not in Appalachia. I don't know where, you know, slavery might exist somewhere, but...
Right. You know. But, you know, for some people, for a 19-year-old kid with no family ties and nothing else to do, I'll work a 14-hour day.
Yeah, or 18-hour day.
Or whatever,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'll work it. Sure, why not? I've got nothing else to do. I'm young. I can handle it. It gives me a good supply of money so that I can have a future, you know. But now, all of a sudden, no. You have to work 8 hours, and that's it. You can only work 8 hours.
Yeah, because no matter what you might have privately decided between you and employer, now you can't do that anymore because there's all these levels of rules.
Right. And so it takes away that freedom of choice, that freedom to say, I can't work today, I have to work on my farm. No, you can't do that, or you'll lose your job.
Yeah.
Or, I would like to work as many hours as I can. No, sorry, you have to work this specific number of hours, and you have to be paid this specific amount.
And within the Appalachian culture, what the result of this was that it lifted the male the alpha males out of families. It lifted the alpha males out of families and took them away from the farm mm-hmm. for the majority of their time, and therefore the younger males did not have the role model in those critical years from like about 10 to about 18.
Not only the males, the females too.
Yeah.
Because it, as important as it is for a young boy to have a strong father influence, it is as important for a young girl to have a strong father influence. Otherwise, they don't have that role model of what they're looking for in a partner.
Yeah. And at this, tragically, at the same time, government schools, this is around 1900 and coming up into the 1920s, at the same time, government schools started to invade mm-hmm. Appalachia, bringing in government standards and mm-hmm. government books and government-type teaching.
Which was you know, this huge convenience.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden, you have the fathers of the family being pulled out.
Mm-hmm.
And the mothers are left, and the mothers still have to run the household.
Right.
But now they have all these children underfoot mm-hmm. that they don't, they only have one person there to control them.
Right.
So ship them off to public school.
Right. The government first provides a problem, then the government provides an answer, but the answer never actually solves the problem. It just makes it worse.
Right.
Okay, now we've talked all this about Appalachia. And, again, we don't want to take the whole podcast to Appalachia, so I want to tie that to mountainous people in other regions and how the hill people and the mountainous people and the people in deep forests where it's hard for the state to really get a grip on them have...
Or vast nomadic, like in the deserts.
Yeah, nomadic areas that are hard to control by the state. These people have a tendency throughout history to be stateless mm-hmm. and to live peaceably.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't realize you have the East Coast media has a tendency to paint Appalachia as being these violent hillbillies constantly in feuds with each other, shooting at each other. That's all lies. That's all just made up by the East Coast media. The great tendency of the hill people are to be peaceable.
Mm-hmm.
They literally, they don't have army,
mm-hmm.
you know, they don't have wars. You never hear of the people of Appalachia invading Ohio.
Right.
You know, that it just didn't happen. You never hear the people of, the mountain people of Southeast Asia invading the lowlanders of Cambodia.
Right.
At this point, I want to bring up the book, The Art of Not Being Governed, by James C. Scott. The subtitle of that book is...
An Anarchist History of Upland Southeast Asia.
She has to read it because it's upside down to me. It's sitting on my desk. Now, I want to compare James C. Scott's dealing with these cultures with another very well-known author, Jared Diamond. Jared Diamond is...
That's a terrible name. That sounds like some WWE wrestler.
Jared Diamond. Jared Diamond is an excellent writer. He writes in a way that makes you just... you can't wait to read more of it. He's such a good writer. And he, in his book, Guns, Germs, and Steel... it's gripping and it's fascinating, and he lays out so many facts, and he spent so many years doing such in-depth research, and he's still wrong on almost every one of his major points, because he's such a statist, and everything in his mind all adds together to the same conclusions, and no matter what he's looking at, no matter what evidence he's looking at, it always leads him to the conclusion that he wanted to have to begin with,
right.
Which is how great the state is. And he comes up with these weird explanations for why some cultures developed functional states and conquered everybody else, and why others didn't. And he's almost every single point that he makes is wrong. Whereas James C. Scott is just as meticulous, is just as knowledgeable, is just as thorough in his handling of the discussion. It's just that his reading is horribly boring. If James C. Scott could write like Jared Diamond, we'd win. But unfortunately, James C. Scott is very scholarly, and his book The Art of Not Being Governed is very fact-filled and very thoroughly researched, but really hard to read. But super important, because he goes through and lists all the reasons why hill people and people living in swamps and people living in marshes and people living in dense forests and people living on islands separated from the state's reach develop their own vibrant, successful cultures without the state, and yet the state requires flatlands, heavy grain farming, slavery, all those things develop through the state, mm-hmm. whereas the free people living in hills, the hill people of Appalachia, the hill people of Israel, the hill people, the nomadic people of North Africa, the Bedouins on the Arabian Peninsula, these people have a tendency to live state-free and without war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't really remember the last time that the Bedouins attacked anyone.
They were very defensive. You didn't want to go mess with the Bedouins. You know, even the Turkish, when the Ottoman Empire controlled that whole area, the Ottomans knew better than to march into there and try to be, you know, all state-like with the Bedouins. Because they just pick them apart. It was the death of a thousand knives. Mm-hmm. They come at them from every direction. And that's what the hill people do. That's what nomadic people do. That's what swamp people do. They don't fight in massed armies. Mm-hmm. Take a look at Afghanistan. The graveyard of empires. How many empires have attempted to go into Afghanistan and bring the state to those people? And how do they combat it? When the state's armies are right in their face, they cheer them. Yay! Yay! Good, the Soviets are here. Hey, we love the Persians. Hooray for the Persians. Alexander's a cool dude. We like that Alexander. Yay, USA. Go, go, America. And then the second the individual soldier turns his back, he's got a knife shoved into his liver. Mm-hmm. And that's how they have fought for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm. Because that's the only way you can fight the state.
Yeah. Successfully fighting the state is the act of guerrilla warfare. Mm-hmm. That's how it's done.
Yeah. And it requires the determined idea that you are never going to finish fighting the state.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not a matter of controlling land. It's not a matter of controlling a specific geographic area or a base or a city. It's a matter of constantly jab, jab, jab and run, jab and run. Mm-hmm. You hit and you disappear into the population. And as you do that, this is why it was so difficult. The difference between dealing with the Great Plains Indians in the Old West, you know. Mm-hmm. They were migratory, mm-hmm. Or not migratory, they were nomadic, mm-hmm. But they tended to be all in one place, and it wasn't that hard to find them,
right.
So to speak, you know. On the other hand, when you get down into New Mexico and Arizona, along the Mexican border, trying to deal with Cochise and trying to deal with Geronimo and the method of fighting that they utilized down there, They simply didn't. There were no giant great battles,
right.
in dealing with Cochise and in dealing with Geronimo. They blended into the mountains, and when you look for them, you couldn't find them. As soon as you stopped looking, they hit you, and then they disappeared again. Mm-hmm. Northern Mexico, the Mexican government never really effectively dealt with these natives. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, go back before the Mexican government, go into the days of the great empires of southern Mexico, of the Incas and so forth. They could never move north through the Sierra Madres because the mountain people fought that way, mm-hmm. pre-Columbian. Mm-hmm. So the empires of Central America could never move north. And you see this in the Mississippian culture in North America. The Mississippians were able to build empires where? In the flatlands and the basins around the big rivers.
Right.
But not in the mountains. They just could not, the empires could not fall out into the mountains because the mountain tribes would just cut them to pieces.
And the swamps.
Yeah.
In Louisiana.
Yeah.
Florida.
We could get off into the Seminoles, too, mm-hmm. and talk about how the only way to deal with the Seminoles in the swamps of Florida was to leave them alone.
Yeah.
But anyway, I wanted to make that comparison between Jared Diamond and James C. Scott, that they both look at the same situation, and James C. Scott says, this is how non-state civilizations function, and this is why they function like this. And Jared Diamond immediately twists it and says that the hill people are uncivilized and backwards, and the people living in the state are successful. Mm-hmm. You know, when I'm not sure that's the case. For me, success is not being a slave. Mm-hmm. I don't see that as success. You know.
Yep. Even if you do get pretty shiny toys and, you know, it doesn't matter if you have the prettiest collar and the shiniest collar and the collar has diamonds, it's still a collar.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. I like that.
The other thing that we wanted to bring up was, and just briefly touch on it, because it's really interesting. When you talk to valley people, lowland people, plains people, all of them have mythology of being entirely fearful of the woods and the forests and the deserts and the swamps and the marshes and
mountains.
They don't want to go in there. They're afraid the people who are in there are going to snatch you away.
Yeah.
And you have
witches
to
live in the forest.
Away and
the wolves live in the mountains. Mm-hmm. They'll get you. The witches live in the forest. The gnomes are out there. They'll get you. The the elf children will come out of the swamps and take you away. Mm-hmm. And there's all these myths that that mothers lie to their children with to keep them from going out there and. Because how could you possibly live outside of the state? Mm-hmm. We can't have that.
You have to, you have to have your walled cities to keep you safe.
Yeah, even though the whole time it's the state that is the dangerous thing. It's the state that rounds people up and kills them en masse. Mm-hmm. It's the state that drafts you into an army and makes you sit shoulder to shoulder in a trench while your enemy is bombing you, or it makes you stand shoulder to shoulder with another group of men and march directly into a line of fire, or, you know, it's the state that scoops you up and sends you to a foreign land where the people don't want you there and they are constantly trying to blow you up.
Or it's the state that takes, you know, a tithe of your income and you know, tells you what you can and can't do and locks you away in cages if you do things that have no reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have no victim. They have no... You've not committed a crime, and yet you've broken the rules.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Without going into a big thing, I saw one of our listeners sent me a... I wish I could have gone into it about some Amish people in Kentucky that were arrested because they didn't have the signage correct on their buggies, and so they had to literally are incarcerated for not having the correct signage on their buggies. And so they're not allowed to, by their beliefs, they're not allowed to have pictures taken. Well, so they can't submit to a lineup to, or not a lineup, but a mugshots.
Right.
But the state's going to force them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they have beliefs in regards to this, it doesn't matter. Now, who was harmed by their buggies?
Right.
Well, if somebody was harmed, if a wreck took place or whatever, then deal with that wreck. Deal with the harm that was taking place in that wreck. But don't harm them because something might have happened.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to incarcerate somebody because something could have happened? Well, then who doesn't get incarcerated?
Right.
You know, once you start jailing people for the potential of a crime, then there's no end to what can be defined as crime.
Right.
Folks, keep listening to us. We're going to be back Wednesday with any, if everything goes well, we will be back next Wednesday.
Hopefully.
Assuming another series of events don't take place. And we will try either way to get you another podcast Wednesday. And we're going to do everything we can to get more interviews and more articles up. Be sure and have a listen to that interview with Alan. That was really, I think that really is important. I, you know, if my lack of skill as an interviewer prevents somebody from hearing what Alan says and what the point is, then that's very unfortunate. But the message really needs to get out there that there is an entire population of people that have been abused by this system. So be sure and check back with us. Email us, ben@badquaker.com. And
hi, ki@badquaker.com.
Thanks a lot for listening, folks.